God is good.
All the time.
All the time.
God is good.
Welcome back. Once again, I'm Alex with Underground Ministries. Is there anything that you guys reflected on or just thought about over the night? A question, maybe?
I like the downward focus to helping release prisoners, Hades, that kind of thing. It reminded me of Lucifer, the show on Netflix. Like, that's the end of the show, is Lucifer coming and being able to redeem all the people in hell, and I just thought it was really interesting. I mean, it's not a great theological show, but it's a very good show. But anyway, I saw that connection and I liked it.
Awesome. Anything else? Okay, so today we're going to go into the tombs, and Chris is going to lead us off with that.
Thank you, sir. So, good morning.
Good morning.
I think I'm on. Am I on?
Yeah.
Okay, great. As a reminder from yesterday, it's possible I might cough a couple times. I'm still getting over the sinus infection. So I like to preface that since I'm now in the maskless state, but I'm trying to stay away from y'all. So, anyway. Thank you for both for being here yesterday and then also for coming back today. Or if you weren't here yesterday, thanks for making it today. Again, my name is Chris Odie, and I'm honored to serve as the pastor of what is known as the Living Stones Prison Congregation. So part of what I'm going to be talking about today is not just about Living Stones, but also kind of the idea behind it, the ethos behind it, you could say the theology behind it, and how it connects not only to the work that I get to do, but also how it connects into your own lives, and if you are a part of a community of faith, it as well. There are some... Chris and Alex brought so much more cool stuff than I did, which I'm very grateful for. What I brought is this brochure, and I would encourage you, in fact, I'd beg you to take one with you when you leave, so that I don't have to take them all back with me. But it gives you a little bit of an idea of who we are and what we do. During our intros yesterday on the subject of why, I kind of gave you the really short version of why for me, just to kind of break the ice. But I wanted to take a moment now to tell you a little bit more about the why for me, and then use that to kind of jump into what we do. So I am an ELCA pastor, a Lutheran pastor, and as of 2 days ago, have been one for 13 years. Happy Ordin of Anniversary to me. So, I seem to have a habit of accepting calls into odd situations for whatever reason. I think it says probably a lot about who I am as a person. When Chris was sharing yesterday, we grew up in different types of congregations, but I think we had in some ways similar childhoods in terms of just being enmeshed in church. I'm not a pastor's kid, but I'm a church secretary's kid. So, which meant I was voluntold a lot as a child. Grew up in the church office, knew where everything was. I actually remember as a kid growing up thumbing through various church catalogs and thinking like, oh, that stole's really cool. Da, 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 da. In hindsight, I'm like, wow, I was such a dork. Although I still am, so it's okay. Yeah, past tense. Why would I use that? I grew up very heavily involved in my congregation as a kid. I served on the youth council, and actually the first time I came to Holden was for the church, the youth May weekends, back in the early 90s, and then eventually helped plan some of them, coming up here in the winter and all of that. When I went off to college, knowing that I was a proud Northwesterner, which I am, an obnoxiously proud Washingtonian, I very much self-identify as a Cascadian before almost anything else. The natural thing to do was to go off to PLU in Tacoma, because it was close and it was Lutheran, and so was I, so I'm like, okay, that's where I'll go. I didn't know what I was going to do at all. So my first semester there, I remember taking a personality class, a career planning course, not really knowing, you know, what to do. And it was like a half semester or so, like a credit. I don't remember anything other than at the end we got this dot matrix printout of like our top choices based on these personality inventories, interviews, other stuff we had done. The first thing on my list was pastor, which I immediately said, that's not happening. So I looked down at number two, which was psychologist, and I decided, oh, I guess I'm a psych major now. Number three, for the record, was dictionary editor.
Wow.
Not a joke. Like, that's how my OCD manifests. So having seen that, I went through, became a psych major, and graduated in 2000 with this degree and no idea what to do with it. So I did what a lot of folks do, and I took some time off, in this case, to drive around the country. Spent about 2 months driving around the country. This is early 2001. So right before, pre-9/11, so things were a little different. Had some wonderful experiences driving around and such. Came back, and the dot-com crash had just happened. So finding employment as a newly graduated college student with a degree and really still no direction was challenging. So I took a lot of weird jobs. I worked as a coffee barista, a barista bro, what would that be anyway? No? Thanks, Sarah. I'm so glad you're here for my comedy. I was a barista, sold books, drove a paratransit bus, became a social worker for the Tacoma Lutheran Home on their Alzheimer's, their dementia unit. Just random, odd jobs. Worked as a research coordinator for a drug testing company. We didn't actually design any drugs, we just tested them. I like to refer to it as my time working for evil. And then eventually, somewhere during that, of all things, went and saw a showing of Jesus Christ Superstar at Paramount in Seattle with Sarah. And on the way home, I was oddly quiet, which for those who know me is odd. And so she, as we were just dating at the time, had said to me, you seem kind of a little quiet. What's up? And I said, I don't know how to tell you this, but I think I'm supposed to go to seminary. I think I'm supposed to be a pastor. And we'd only been dating for a few months at this point. Like, things, I didn't really know exactly where the relationship was going to go. I know I had hopes. And as I said this to her, feeling very vulnerable and scared as to how she would respond, because she's a PK. Without missing a beat, she said, oh, yeah, I knew that. Now I'm just waiting for you to figure it out. So a little bit of time passed, continuing to shuffle things out, went down to Berkeley to Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary down there, had a wonderful time, worked in an urban congregation in downtown San Francisco at St. Mark's Lutheran Church, beautiful location, and a very strong community there. And then for internship, we kind of decided mutually that, well, you know, there's a lot of folks in Lutheran Church with a Midwest connection, we've never been out there. There's a lot of small rural congregations, we've never really done that before, so let's do a rural internship. We can survive anything for a year. We did survive it for a year. Went out to North Central Ohio, Bucyrus and Nevada, Ohio. I learned while I was out there, it's about halfway between the Columbus and the lake, I learned while I was out there that every city that exists, there is a version of that with that name in Ohio, but they pronounce it wrong. It was an interesting year to be out there. It was the run-up to the 2008 election. I don't know how much of you remember that. It seems like so small now after everything we've been through as a country the last few years. But I know that for me, it was kind of shocking because I remember going into that election hearing, you know, at this point it was Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were the two front runners for the Democrats. And I remember as we were out there in North Central rural Ohio hearing some of the most racist and sexist crap ever leading into that election. And these were from the Democrats who planned to vote for one of them. It was so surreal. It was so weird. It was so not what I was used to. And so after that, I came back to Berkeley and finished off our last year in seminary and then accepted a call at a small rural congregation at the mouth of the Columbia River, Chinook, Washington, population 457, which is smaller than my graduating class from high school, by 200 people. Served there for almost 3 years and then accepted a call into Shoreline, Washington, a suburb just north of Seattle, into a congregation that was struggling dramatically. They had dropped from around 350 on a Sunday down to about three dozen over the course of less than a decade. nothing icky had happened, just some, let's just call it a misfit between leadership and congregation. While I was there, I helped that congregation, and this is where I promise if we'll start having a point, we're going to bring it home back to the prison. What's worse is I'm preaching tonight, folks. Thanks, Tim. I like that I knew you were up there before.
It helps.
Well, I was at this congregation in Shoreline. Part of what I ended up doing with them was helping them as a community go through a discernment process involving their aging building, which they had lovingly cared for 75, 85 years. But it was falling down around them, decades of deferred maintenance and budget issues and this dwindling congregation that was trying to hold on to something they just couldn't anymore, trying to recapture something from the past that just was frankly never going to come back. And so going through this process with them of wrestling with their budget and reality and their numbers and having one-on-ones and coffee and preaching and classes and just all of this hard work dredging up old baggage from the past, wounds that had never been addressed, traumas within the congregation, broken relationships and grudges and all of this stuff. And it was so much mental work and so much emotional work and so much counseling work. And it was exhausting. It was so exhausting. There were weeks there where I literally would look back and I would realize that I had worked over 100 hours that week. But I had two little kids and a mortgage and my wife was working part-time as a waitress. And I knew that if I didn't get this right, we could lose everything. And so on the one hand, I cared deeply for the congregation, and on the other hand, I was terrified for myself and my family. And I was exhausted, and I was burnt out. I was a husk, frankly. I didn't know if I was still supposed to do ministry. It was so hard emotionally. I remember one night just breaking down in our bedroom with Sarah and just rocking back and forth, clutching my knees and weeping and just saying, I am so broken. I felt like I was failing as a pastor and as a husband and as a father. And eventually, over time, as a community, the congregation made the decision to sell and to move unanimously. Unanimously, they voted to let go of this aging building, to sell it to a Buddhist monastery. And then we took the proceeds, and I kid you not, we bought a yoga studio that was actually a Hindu temple. And then the Hindus moved in with the Unitarians in North Seattle, because it was Seattle. And we moved into this new building, and everything seemed so good. It was this multi-purpose space that the previous tenants had completely redone the inside. They'd taken this old dive bar that the cops used to sit outside and wait for the fights, and they had remodeled it into a house of worship. And we had this space that we could use for us and for all the 12-step groups and for the day center that we have for young adults with physical and developmental disabilities and for a cooperative preschool, and a Lutheran Counseling Network person came in, and all of this awesome stuff, and the secretary who'd been there 40 years, which ironically was the same length of time my mother served, so let's talk about the psychology of all this. She finally decided to retire. And so we brought in this new young grad from PLU, this kind of comm major theology kind of person who's going to help us engage with the neighborhood and do some organizing. And I had some organizing training. It was going to be awesome. And as we did all this, I realized, I think I'm done. I think my role in all of this was to get us to here, but I don't think I'm the one who gets to go into the promised land. If you'll pardon me making a really obnoxious comparison. I promise you, I know I'm not Moses. And in the midst of all of this, a dear friend of mine who worked in the Synod office in Tacoma reached out and she said, Chris, I'd like to talk to you about Living Stones. Because the ministry, I didn't found it. It's been around since 2006. So I'd like to talk to you about Living Stones. And I said, well, Mel, I didn't know I had prison ministry on my paperwork. She said, you don't. I just thought you'd be good at it. And I thought to myself, well, that's very kind. But I'm not street smart. I'm not a tough guy. I'm a giant gamer dork. This does not make any sense. But I like and respect Melanie, and I'm pretty sure if I go to Tacoma, she'll buy me a latte. So, sure, I'll head down. I'll listen to your pitch. And I did, and she gave me the pitch, and she talked to me about living stones, and I thought to myself, no, this doesn't make any sense. But yeah, sure, I'll meet the call committee. And so I went. I'm at the call committee thinking to myself the whole time, this is such a waste of everybody's time. I'm never going to take this call. Sure, here's some thoughts, did some research, this sounds really interesting. I'm not the right guy for this. Would you meet the guys? Well, now this is just mean. I'm going to be leading them on. I'm never going to take this call. This is ridiculous. I don't even know if I'm still supposed to be a pastor. Oh, fine, I'll go in. It'll be an experience. So I went into worship. And I fell in love. In a place that I expected to find devastation and depression and a void, I was saved. I walked into this community of faith of individuals wearing tan clothing, tops and bottoms, and gray jumpsuits, and I was welcomed, and I was loved. And I recognized that in their brokenness and in their community was the place that I was supposed to be next. And on the way home, they gave me a call and said, we really would like you to accept the call. We'd like to call you as the next pastor of Living Stones. And I said, I need to talk to my wife. Because up until now, I did not know that this was about to happen. So that's part of my why. That's how I got in there. It's not as gritty, it's not as raw and real. It's personal for me. My experience of doing prison ministry is that for many individuals, they walk into the prison thinking that they are there to bring something in. That we bring in the gospel, we bring in the Spirit, we bring in Jesus, we bring in whatever. And that's not the case. We go in and we listen. We go in, and in many ways, we receive. In some ways, we actually take out. Although we do it in a way that the DOC is totally cool with. Because there's a lot of things we're not supposed to take out. Pretty much everything we're not supposed to take out. When we gather for Living Stones, the way that it works, it uses a model that is based on something called the Prison Congregations of America. And the concept is to embed a community of faith in a prison. So again, I don't have an outside church that I can bring in with me. My congregation is this incarcerated community in these prisons in Washington State. And I guess related to that, I want to clarify up front a couple things. One, almost anything that I will speak of and can speak of will be through that prism of Washington State, because that is the place that I serve. Please understand that in no way, shape, or form am I trying to claim any kind of expertise beyond my own lived experience in that regard. And additionally, for the most part, I'm going to be referring to what it means to minister and work with individuals in male-identified prisons. And it's not because the female-identified prisons don't matter. It's not because there aren't ministries happening there. It's because that's not where I serve. But I also deliberately refer to it as a male-identified prison because I do have several congregants who are transgender and who are in the wrong place, if you follow what I mean by that. Gender identity is a very tricky thing within the prison system. It's very interesting for me as a cisgender, heterosexual, able-bodied, white male, probably more privilege I can throw in there, education, economy, etc., etc. It's interesting to be in the situation in which you are working with so many individuals who do not have those privileges and those advantages, but also where things become a little more complicated. Since I'm on that topic right now, I'll just dive straight into it. For example, there is an individual who I have been working with and ministering to now for most of the pandemic. Ironically, she keeps getting jumped around to whatever prison I happen to be at. It's not anything I'm doing or that she's doing. It just seems to be the way things are working. This individual has been through a lot. She has a lot of trauma, and as you might imagine, in her background. But it's very complicated because on the one hand, there is the part of me as the justice-oriented pastor who very strongly believes that she should not be in this facility because it's dangerous for her. But on the other hand, there's also the part of me that knows that the reason that she is currently incarcerated is because of violent sexual crimes that she committed against women. In particular, you know, cisgendered women. And within the DOC, there is a classification that they call PREA, the Prison Rape Elimination Act. And every individual who goes inside is classified as either a potential predator or a potential victim, or neither, which is what most are, or both. And in this person's case, she is dual classified, which makes it very complicated. Because what do you do? This is a child of God. This is a human being. This is a scared person who does, in fact, have a soul and the right to live and the need to be loved. And at the same time, this is someone who, from the trauma and mental illness and other things in her story and in her background, is not an easy case to deal with. I think it's actually one of the reasons why I keep running into her, is because no one else really wants to deal with her. Anywho. So in the state of Washington, we have 11 prisons. This is a map of Washington. Hopefully you all knew that. It's labeled for one, so even if you didn't know the shape. In Washington State, approximately 60% of the population lives between Olympia and Everett, this Puget Sound right here. Somewhere between 60 and two-thirds. As a state, when it comes to the geography, we're deceptively rural. The vast majority of our population is very urbanized, and yet the vast majority of our land is very rural. And those of you who've ever seen a map of our voting patterns immediately know that, because you always see like these little clumps of blue in the center, and then you see these wide expanses of red, and at the same time, land doesn't vote. So, anywho. But what you might notice when you look at this, if we zoom out just a little bit, is that the majority of these red dots that indicate to you where our prisons are, many of them are very scattered away from where the majority of the people live. And we touched on this a little bit yesterday, and why do you think that is?
It's big and expensive.
Yeah, prisons are big and expensive.
Yeah. NIMBY.
Yeah. What? NIMBY, yeah. Yeah, no one wants a prison in their backyard, right? I find the most amusing prison, it's a weird thing to say, the one whose location amuses me the most is Monroe, up here. And the reason that I say that is because Monroe is the prison that is closest to Puget Sound, closest to what I like to call Pugetopolis. But I don't personally believe, if it didn't already exist, if it wasn't 100 years old, I don't believe for a moment we'd build a new prison.
No.
Because it's too close.
Yeah.
Because no one would look at that hill overlooking that valley and say, you know, this land is beautiful. What a gorgeous example of creation. You know what would make it even better? Giant-ass prison right here. In fact, let's build 5 of them. Because you may not know this, but that's what Monroe is. Monroe is not one prison. It's actually a complex of 5. It has the minimum security unit. It has the Twin Rivers unit, where I just spent 5 months serving as the de facto chaplain for the prison, which was awful. We'll probably talk about that later. The Washington State Reformatory Unit, which is the old prison up there. If you've ever seen Shawshank, it looks like that. The big stone walls going around the facility, the open bars looking out on the, you know, the walkway. It has the Special Offenders Unit, because we need to make sure we have a prison just for people who are mentally ill. What an interesting country we live in. And it has its own, as we talked about yesterday, intensive management unit, the IMU, solitary seg, the whole. And these 5 prisons all function somewhat together and somewhat independently. It's an amazing example of bureaucracy and dysfunction at work. You have different staff who function and serve at each one of these units with very little crossover. And so you have different ecologies and different hierarchies and different bureaucracies and different internal politics. And right now, because in Washington there's been some budget cuts made, you've got a bunch of shuffling of staff and it's all based on seniority, so people are losing their jobs and being shunted to other places, so everyone's cranky because no one knows who's in charge. And all that dysfunction within the system itself, it doesn't make life easier for the people who are incarcerated. Because things tend to roll downhill. But having our prisons like this does some other things too, because as you might imagine, this is the one I hate the most.
Oh.
I hate Coyote Ridge with burning passion.
Me too. I visited it there.
I hate Coyote Ridge. Where is it?
It's in Connell, which is about 35 miles north of what's known as the Tri-Cities. It is the middle of frickin' nowhere,
yeah.
To be brutally honest.
Yeah.
Not far from Eltopia, which was once known as Hell to Pay.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, and it's there because it's far
from. Because it's far from everything. Connell is halfway between Ritzville and the Tri-Cities. If you were to look at it from an aerial satellite view, you would see brown.
Yes.
Gray. It is a hellscape. It's one of our largest prisons in the state. It's one of our newest prisons in the state. But it's there, and it's there because the land is cheap. It's there because it's out of the way, we don't have to think about it. But there, and it's there because for the people who live in that area, it's a job creator. It literally is, and I get that. In my work inside, I've gotten to know and care about several individuals who work within the Department of Corrections. I do honestly believe that most of the staff who works there are actually pretty decent people. But that said, they're working in a toxic environment. They're working in an environment that is toxic for those who are incarcerated, and they're working in an environment that is also toxic for themselves.
Quick question.
Yeah.
Are these, does Washington have private prisons, or are these all public prisons?
These are all public prisons, or state prisons.
State prisons.
Have been times in which Washington has offloaded individuals out of state. And we have at times taken individuals from out of state in.
But
currently all of these are state-run institutions, and we don't currently have any private prisons in the state.
Okay.
Immigration.
We don't have any private state prisons for...
For...
Immigration's own thing. Like, don't get me wrong. You're right.
You're right.
Yeah.
But...
Not in the DOC.
Yeah, not in the DOC.
Yeah.
Which doesn't fit... I mean, yeah. I was going to say, this plays out in big ways and small ways. You may have heard about this pandemic that we have had going around.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone, you've heard about that? This is thing?
Yeah.
So throughout the pandemic, as we all know, it's become a very politicized issue. Well, this has had real world implications within the Department of Corrections. Because as you might imagine, most people who work at one of these sites live in that area. Is no one wants to commute out to Connell from Tacoma. That's not a thing. So as a result, the majority of the individuals who work within the facilities, for better or for worse, are going to reflect the population who are around them. And where that has played out throughout the pandemic has oftentimes played out when it's come to issues around masking, around vaccination. Until the state mandate was implemented, time has stopped meaning anything to me the last couple of years. I think that was last year that it happened.
It was October.
Thank you. Before the mandate was done in Washington State, the DOC had a vaccination rate of staff of somewhere in the low 60 percentile. Since then, now it's in the mid to high 90s. But it took a mandate to get us there because it was an uphill climb. On a side note, I was kind of amused during all of that because I kept reading these hand-waving articles in the Seattle Times, or people talking on the radio about, like, oh, all these people are gonna quit. If you make them get vaccinated, they're gonna quit. We're gonna lose all these staff. And I was thinking to myself, no, I work with these guys. The same guy who's the most irritated about the idea of getting vaxxed he's the same guy who can tell me the exact day that he's retiring and how much is in his pension. There's no way he walks away from that. And in you know, 95% of the time, that was true. Anyway, the geographic location of these prisons is in many ways something that I think convicts us as a culture because of what we have done, not only in terms of shoving these guys away and putting them out of our minds and our lives, but also the impact that it has on them and on their families. Because as you might imagine, one of the most impactful things for an individual who is experiencing incarceration is the simple act of visitation. The face-to-face, having friends and family, loved ones come around, being reminded that they matter, that someone is still thinking about them, having those moments, those opportunities. And if you're someone who is sitting in the old prison in Monroe, yeah, WSR is a dung hole at best. It's cold and it's hot, depending on what time of year, and not the right way. It's an awful place to be, but for many guys, it's close to home. And if you're there, yeah, the cells are small, but they're so small because they were built for children. That's its own thing. It's an old juvenile facility. But that means because they're so small, you'll have your own cell. And yeah, it sucks, but it's yours. It might be loud, but it's yours. And you're closer to family, most likely, so they can come and see you. And you're closer to programming. Because most of the programming that we get within our system comes from volunteers. Or even if it comes from contractors, it comes from contractors who are coming from the local community colleges or church groups or whatever else. And as a result, when they come inside, by definition, if they come from an area where there are more people, there's more opportunities. I've talked a lot already. But Alex just gave me a thumbs up, so that means he's on board with it. Oh, there's so many things I want to share with you guys. You know what? Let's talk a little bit about Living Stones. Can we just play that video for a moment?
Yes, sir.
It's a lot harder for us to get footage inside, so my video is short. At Living Stones Prison Congregation, we gather in the name of Christ. We hear the Word of God. We share the family meal. And we are sent with the Spirit. We are, just like you, church. In a place where hope can be hard, God still speaks. God's community still gathers, and God's Spirit still prevails. Come and see. So Living Stones is one of about three dozen prison congregations of America-style ministries across the country. We as a state are blessed to have more than one, which is rare. There is a ministry that was begun by the Presbyterians at the women's prison in Purdy back in 2018. Actually, side note, the women's prison in Purdy is actually in Gig Harbor, but we all say it's in Purdy because no one from Gig Harbor wants to admit that that's its actual geographical location. I'm just saying, if you look at anyway, that's maps. We ourselves have been out at the men's prison in Shelton, which in this state is what's called the reception center. As a pastor, it took me a very long time to be comfortable with the idea of referring to it as the reception center. Because when I hear the word reception, I think of weddings and I think of funerals. So that was a little weird. But that means, though, that every male identified individual who has spent time in a Washington State prison began that journey in Shelton. That is where they first showed up, that's where they were processed before eventually being offloaded to some other site. Where they went is determined by a whole host of different issues around their classification, around where there are beds available, around who they are allowed to be around, because many guys, you know, if they either were convicted with someone or if they have been in some sort of, you know, gang situation with someone, there's a lot of reasons why two individuals may not be allowed to be at the same facility. So once the DOC has done all of its bookkeeping in that regard, then someone finds themselves sent off to where, in theory, they will spend the rest of their incarceration, but in practice that's not true. Because what will frequently happen is someone will be in a place for a length of time before either some incident will show up or some staff person will take a dislike to this person or something will go sideways or their classification will change or something else will happen where they will be uprooted and sent off to another facility. And every one of the times that happens, it's very disorienting, because if you can imagine, stability is rare inside. It is a valuable commodity. But it's also something then that is, you can't depend upon it, because you have no control. You know, every day is an example of many, many big and small ways in which the individuals who are in charge control whatever the rest of your day will look like. For us as a worship body, when we gather inside, and it's been different during the pandemic, when we would gather inside, you know, we, in theory, our worship service is from 6:30 to 8:30. But in practice, meh. Maybe. It depends. If there was fog that evening, then things might be delayed. They've called fog line. If there was a staffing issue and someone didn't show up, it's possible that movement will be delayed or possibly just canceled.
What do you mean by movement?
Ah, thank you, Sarah. Movement is just what it sounds like. It's when guys are allowed to move from one location to another. There is no just wandering off to the dining hall for, you know, a cup of coffee. It's all announced. It's all very regulated. It's all very regimented.
Chris, I'm wondering if, as we had looked at that map and you're talking that it's kind of a tomb system of bodies being moved and shuffled around, kind of this warehouse system, what that movement feels like on the inside.
Yeah.
If you want to describe for us, Alex, both the daily movement, and to answer that question, on the inside, as well as being transferred constantly.
So I'm going to start with my tombs. Yeah, to the tombs. So we're talking about entering the tombs. I think I entered the tombs in the sixth grade. I was imprisoned in here in sixth grade. I was getting ready to go for an annual trip, and I was playing basketball in the playground, and I was being attacked by two kids, and I can only take so much, so I defended myself. And the whole time, the PE teacher was watching these kids attack me, and when I defended myself, he got aggressive. He took me by the shirt, dragged me upstairs to the principal, and I got yelled at. And that's when I got my jacket. And a jacket is a label. You're a gang member. Why did you attack these poor kids? And I was bleeding from my face. I was scratched. And I said, what do you mean I'm a gang member? I'm not a gang member. And the whole time I was scared because what's going to happen when they tell my mom? That's going to go worse. So in my head, I was like, I'm not going to tell my mom. I'm not even going to tell my mom that I got dragged up by my shirt. He said, you're a gang member. Look at your shirt. And I looked down. And I was wearing a blue Looney Tunes Tasmanian Devil t-shirt. And it was my favorite shirt. And I was like, but I'm not. And I started crying. And the principal yelled at me. He said, yes, yes, you are. Look at your shirt. So I think that's when I first entered the tombs. Later on that year, the teachers asked the kids, what do you guys want to be when you grow up? You know, everybody said, I want to be a cop or I want to be a teacher, and they got to me, and I said, well, I want to go to prison. I think at that age, I was already imprisoned in my head. And so I grew up, went down that path to where I knew where I wasn't accepted, and I was accepted with the neighborhood gang. And so we, as kids, 11, 12 years old, we started with one gang. And then it kind of split up into different ones. And so 15, 16, I was rivals with my closest friends. They were now my enemies. Started committing crimes against them. assaults with deadly weapons, robberies, and watching, having to bury a friend and having to bury another one before I get over that one. And so, you know, I went into the prison system, went into the tombs, and I remember I couldn't stand looking at myself in the mirror. I hated myself. I didn't know how to accept myself because I was already broken. I didn't know how to be violent. I was scared. The way I mustered up the courage was with drugs. So once I had the drug in my system, then I could be violent because I was scared. I was scared to fight. So within the prison system, I got another jacket, another label, STG, Security Threat Group. And we had to be split, quarantined, Sureño, Norteño, Southside, Northside. It all sounds comical to me now, but that's what it was. And so when I hit Shelton, you're segregated. And so certain gates have to close, keeping them, the other side, away from us while we go movement. There'd be incidents where the guards would let the gates open on purpose. And so the gates would open and there'd be a riot or whatnot. We'd get sent to the hole, segregation.
Alex, why would they want to trigger a riot?
Oh, because they want to send us to the furthest prisons possible. Close custody. Clallam Bay, which is on the tip of the peninsula, or Walla Walla, which is in eastern Washington. Pull up the map.
Yes, sir.
So pulling up the map, Clallam Bay, mm-hmm. up here. That's how I got to know the beautiful Olympic Forest. And Walla Walla. So my home is right here. Walla Walla is right here. When I went to prison, my mom could cook, sing, dance, drive. I was in Walla Walla. She couldn't make the trip. 6-7 years go by. I finally get a visit, and it's behind glass. And my mom comes in with my stepdad, and she's now in a walker. She can no longer do any of those things. And I watch the guard come up to her and take her walker. That is not allowed here. And I watch my dad walk her 5 minutes to me while she was struggling. I was in the hole because they had suspicion that I was involved in a fight that happened over here while I was over here. That's the reason why I was in the hole. And so that was my first visit with my mom after so many years. After I got out of the hole, I finally get to put in for, we call it the other side of the mountains. I want to get sent to the other side of the mountains. Those were my only two options because I was deemed too dangerous to go to any of the other prisons. So inside the bus, there's a prison cell inside the bus. It's a cage within the bus, shackled from your wrist to your waist, to your ankles. So I take that six hour ride. Everybody else in the back of the bus gets a bathroom break. I don't get one. And I have to hold it. And so I hold it, and I finally get to the bay. We call it the bay. And I get sent to segregation before I get to a population, which is still close custody. And my first morning there, you gotta line up at a yellow line in front of your cell to receive your breakfast. And I remember the night before, everybody talking about pancakes. It's pancake day. You get peanut butter with your pancakes. I was at my line. The CO walks by, looks at me, and just passes me. And I'm like, hey, where's my breakfast? He says, you weren't at your line. I said, I'm at my line. He says, nope, you're going to have to wait till tomorrow. That was the first time I told somebody I'm sorry in a long time. I said, I'm sorry. Like, I'm sorry. I'm not, can I get my breakfast? I don't know why I said I was sorry. I just felt hurt. I felt broken. But, there is tombs within the tombs. Segregation. There's a whole other prison within the prison. And that's solitary confinement. Out of my 6 years of solitary confinement, it wasn't all one stretch. It was 24 months here, 18 months there, 12 months there. But I remained at about 150 pounds while I was in prison. I'm 260 right now. I work good, I know. I'm 260. I remained at about 150 malnourished. I don't know if you could pull up the picture, Chris. You have a picture of me?
Which one?
Just the slide, the one where we're standing side by side.
That one's, yeah.
That's me. After 24 months in the hole, I'm wearing a Seahawks emblem. I'm a Cowboys fan. Don't tell nobody about that. But yeah, that was a malnourished. Yeah, it was. I mean, I understand. I made choices that put myself in there. I'm always gonna own up to that. But the treatment in there is something else. And yeah, that's a little bit about the tombs from my perspective.
Yeah, Al, you tagged on two things there I want to follow up on, and you made a reference to they use the terminology the security threat group, STG gang is how it would normally be. You know, we would talk about on the outside. I had one of the most surreal experiences of that a few months back at Monroe, where. It would be funny if it wasn't so tragic. I mentioned earlier that I'm a gamer geek, and early on that came out, and a couple guys inside were able to figure out that like I'm a D&D player, you know, Dungeons and Dragons tabletop RPG kind of thing, and so this one guy was talking to me, and he had just gotten flagged that day for one of the COs had seen him with a Pathfinder, but it's a RPG system, had seen him with a book, and as a result had tagged him as a member of an SCG, and as a leader in it, because he was identified as the game master for the D&D group. Like, stop thinking about the insanity of that for a moment. Like, because they thought that he was running an RPG, all of a sudden, he's now going to be classified and treated and infracted the same as if they thought he was leading a local Norteños group or, you know, running with the Bloods or something like that. But because this CO had, because this correctional officer, because this guard had come to that conclusion, this is now in the guy's, it's in his log, it's in his records, and all of that stuff is in there. And now there's this entire process in which he's been given an infraction for that, there's going to have to be a hearing, and like, he's going to be thrown into the hole for a while, and like all this stuff is going on because someone saw him reading a book with the label of an RPG system on it. And like, it would be funny if it wasn't literally destroying part of his life. He eventually was able to get it expunged, but it took 5 months of process before this finally went away. You know, once someone gets these labels, once they get their, you know, as you call it, jack on the inside, like, yeah. Once someone gets this label, both inside and outside, it becomes incredibly difficult for them to shake it, or to be allowed to shake it, to be allowed to move forward. There was something else you said.
The correctional officers will feed off that. Like, if you're an STG label, like, even if you're not doing anything, I remember I got pulled to a holding cell in Walla Walla, and they stripped me down. There was three of them. They said, let's look at your tattoos. So when you first go to Shelton, they take pictures of all your tattoos. Mind me, I didn't get none of my tattoos in prison because I'm scared of, I overthink everything. I don't want no Epsi, I don't want anything. So all my tattoos were done by my brother. They strip searched me, and they said, that tattoo on your back, you didn't have it. We're going to send you to the hole. I said, look at my file. All the pictures are there. I have Sanchez across my back. I got that when I was 12 years old. Part of the lifestyle. I started getting tattooed at a young age. And so the sergeant came back and he said, hey, I remember that picture. It was in your file. For some strange reason, it's not in there anymore. So they sent me to the hole. My niece had just bought me my TV. I've been waiting for my TV for 2 years. She bought me my TV. I get out of the hole. 30 days later, my TV's broken. It's part of the process. It got broken while we were moving it. So they did all that so they could destroy something of mine. And that's, yeah, they feed off the STG, and that's just part of the tombs.
Yeah.
Anything else, Chris?
Sure.
You wanna?
So, just kind of, I know that looking at the clock and thinking about the rest of where the day will go, and eventually we'll. Today is Tomb Day, so we're here, as it were. Sure, just one quick second.
Sure.
There's a picture, if you could throw it up for a second there, Chris.
Which one?
That mural. There's a lot of art around Holden. You've got to have noticed that by now. And walking in today, I was reminded, in the bathroom here actually, I was reminded of one of my favorite pieces here, and it's this mural, which you may recognize as part of the creation cycle from the Sistine Chapel. And it's been made with broken pieces of pottery that were otherwise going to be thrown into the landfill here. And someone went and created this instead. And then it's sitting in the bathroom, which is just kind of entertaining in its own way. But I was reminded when I saw that of part of what I love about the work that we get to do. And what that is that at the end of the day, whatever someone's story, their baggage, their situation, as Christians, we believe and preach and teach and live that every human being is still a child of God. Whatever the prior stuff, they're a child of God. There is value there. There is just inherent value as being, period. And one of the things that I've really valued about this experience the last 4 years in this ministry has been getting to work with guys and help them find ways in which to use their gifts, their stories, their situation to find hope, both for themselves and for others. There's a guy I've been working with who, I'm going to share his story briefly, and then I think actually some questions would be the place to go to next. When I first met him, I'm going to call him Gary. That's the name I'm going to use today. I change it every time I tell it. But he's a real person. When I met Gary, he had been down for almost 40 years at that point. In the early 80s, he'd gone through a story that I don't need to share with you, but he'd had a rough childhood, let's just leave it at that, and was running with some rough crowds in Tacoma. And eventually he was involved in a shooting and was convicted of murder and found himself inside the state prison system. By his own admission, when he first got there, he was angry and he was a hothead. And on the inside, he was picking fights and he was dealing and he was involved in all sorts of problems on the inside, and he was getting shuffled around from facility to facility. Somewhere along the way, he showed up basically on a lark, just kind of bored at one point for a worship service. And for whatever reason, liked it, and he decided to go back again. And that continued for a while, until then he started eventually deciding he wanted to be a leader within that group. He continued to serve his time because he was life without parole, LWAP, as they say. And so over time, he became more involved in different programs inside and activities. And then eventually, while he was sitting out at, well, not the map, out by Aberdeen, out of Stafford, he became involved in some unofficial mentoring with guys who were fairly new. Because the truth of the matter is, a lot of the strongest leaders in a positive way inside the system are the guys who've been down for a while and who've reached a certain level of maturity, who have kind of reflected upon their own life and are looking to do something different. And honestly, some of the strongest leaders I've met in that way are the lifers. Guys who have basically reached this point of where they could have said, you know what, I have nothing to lose, you know, to hell with everyone. Or guys who say, you know what, if I'm going to be here, I'm going to make this the best that I can out of it. So he started doing some mentoring work, and eventually that became more official. He developed a program with some of the staff out at Stafford. And then eventually he was shifted over to Shelton, which is where I met him. They transferred him over there because they wanted him to do some of that work with some of the guys who were coming in. And then during the pandemic, he actually was able to apply for clemency. which is a process where, regardless of what your sentence is, if you're granted it, you can finally be released. And so about 6 months into the pandemic, Gary walked out of the prison as a free man. The clemency board had voted unanimously for him. The governor had signed off on it. He was able to walk out, be with his wife, be with his grandkids, and is now working with a reentry program in South King County. I guess the reason I bring that up is because I believe very strongly in the fact that every person, whatever their crap, there's still something there. It might be harder to find. It might take more work and more time and more effort. But even the most broken people I have worked with, there's still some hope there if we can unlock it, if we can find a way to work with and help them. Or more accurately, help them help themselves. And so, I don't know, when I was looking at that in the bathroom today, of all things, I was just kind of reminded of the ways in which we, it's so easy to just want to throw people away. It's just so easy to be like, nah, it's too much work. But I think the stuff that Underground Ministries does in particular, like, I'm kind of selfishly jealous of what you guys get to do at times. Not that it's because it's hard, don't get me wrong. But, like, the resurrection piece that you get to work with all the time is, it's both inspiring, but it's also hopeful. You know what I mean? Like, it kind of feeds that fire. Never mind. Anyway. No, then never mind. I'm so glad they're recording this. This is good. Listen back to this later. It's all these things I want to share with you. We're not going to do right now. Ray, you got a question. Other people had questions. We've talked a lot today. Fire away.
So, I've heard so far an identification of three things.
Yep.
That the ELCA, Holden Village, Christian communities are working on about racial justice, those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
Then I've heard about people who are incarcerated who are being released that Alex and Chris are working in to help them get back into society to do the regeneration. I've also heard an appalling amount of information about sadism, arbitrary capriciousness of our DOC. Is anybody working on that? Because that is something that could be, with appropriate leadership, organizations can change.
Yeah.
Is that being done, and are there any models in the United States that Washington State should be following?
So yes. So Ray was just asking about some of the brokenness of the DOC system itself. And I will be honest with you that I am probably less of an abolitionist than I think my partner here is. And at the same time, it's not because I don't agree with that. It's because I'm just too much of a pragmatist. Nothing in my lived experience tells me that we're ever going to completely tear it down and then start over or figure something out. I don't have that much faith in humanity. I have faith in God. I just don't have that much faith in people or in systems in particular. I do, however, see signs of hope, and I do see opportunities for change. Within the state of Washington, there's an organization called the Faith Action Network, which works for legislative change. And it's slow, it's grindingly slow, because that's how democracy works, and that oftentimes sucks. But having individuals who are involved in that sort of work, who can speak informatively about some of those problems and address them, is part of that process. They recently hired the governor appointed a new director for the Department of Corrections, whose background is in human and health services. In some ways, that's good, because this person is not coming out of it from, frequently in the DOC, it's a very, you have a lot of guys who go into the DOC, a lot of people who go into the DOC whose background is in the military, which is perfectly fine, but there is a kind of paramilitary mindset, and a lot of the unhealthy elements of that you find in the system. And a lot of the people who rise up the ranks to become the superintendents, the wardens, and the higher-ups in the system oftentimes come out of the custody side. In the DOC, there's basically custody and programming.
Custody's like...
Custody would be the guards. It would be the correctional officers, the technical term. It would be that, the security standpoint. And don't get me wrong, I understand. Like, it's, you know, I get it. But if you step back and think about it, there are different mindsets that tend to go into what brings you to one of those roles. The sort of mindset that makes you say, you know what, I'm going to go be a prison guard, is different than the sort of mindset that makes you say, you know what, I'm going to go work in education in a prison. Like, not completely always, but you can draw some, you know, there's going to be some trends. And typically in the DOC, what has happened is that we have seen individuals almost exclusively from the custody side work their way up the ladder. And I personally think there's a huge problem with that. Not that those individuals cannot or should not be allowed to be in those positions, but it's a very single-minded mindset then that then permeates down throughout the system. In terms of making those changes, part of it is also, it's groups like the Faith Action Network, but it's also, there's the Directly Impacted Caucus, I think it's called. It's a group of family and friends and supporters of loved ones who are currently or have recently been incarcerated that works on pushing the DOC and advocating against some of the abuses that Alex was describing. Because some of this stuff is very true and very arbitrary. Within the Department of Corrections right now, I am classified as a contractor. When you go inside a prison, you always wear a badge, an ID badge. If you're a visitor, it's pink and it just says V123, whatever. If you're a volunteer, it's red and it has your photo on it and you have to give it back every time you come and go. If it's green, that means you're incarcerated. If it's yellow, that means you're a contractor, you have a little bit more freedom. If you're blue, it means you're staff. When I started at Living Stones, I was red, I was a volunteer, and I was treated as such. When I would walk in, I would go through the whole security process and be asked a lot of questions, go through all of this stuff to get inside. And then a few months into my time serving there, the chaplain at the prison in Shelton fell ill. The DOC didn't know what to do. And so they asked me if I would step up, become a yellow badge, become a contractor, serve as their functioning chaplain, basically. The day I got that yellow badge, it was amazing how much had just changed. It was like I had the Willy Wonka golden ticket. I walked in that first day, my shoes stayed on, I didn't have to go through the metal detector, no one checked me on anything, like I could just do whatever the hell I wanted. It was ridiculous. Like, on the one hand, it was really handy for Chris. Mm-hmm. It was much more convenient to just walk in and do my thing. On the other hand, the first week I was there, I accidentally brought my phone inside because no one was checking me. And I was waiting for a group that was showing up late, and so I had it in case they called me. I got into worship that evening. We were beginning worship. Songs were starting. I reached down to my pocket, and I just thought to myself, I just brought in, like, major contraband into the prison. Uh-oh. I'm going to surreptitiously move that into a deeper pocket. We're just going to pretend that's not there. I hope it's turned off. I hope it's on mute. I'm going to check that later. And, like, the only reason I was able to be in that situation was because they didn't check me. And they didn't check me because suddenly I was part of the in crowd. I was safe. During the pandemic, for 2 years, volunteers weren't let inside. For about a year, year and a half, visitors weren't let inside. Guess what? We still had contraband inside. Yeah. It wasn't coming in predominantly through the volunteers. It wasn't coming in predominantly through, you know, the visitors. It was staff. It's the ugly elephant in the room that no one wanted to talk about. But by process of elimination, if the volunteers and the visitors aren't coming in, if you're checking every piece of mail that goes into that facility, if all you've got coming and going are individuals who are incarcerated and staff, well, I'm pretty sure the guys who are inside aren't like just skipping out for a moment and then coming back. You know? That was a long rant about your question. But yes, there's a need to change it, and there are ways to, but it is agonizing.
Well, I was just thinking, like, incarcerated people can't vote when they come out, right? And so
recently in Washington State, some laws were being the legislature was I honestly forget if it passed or not. I remember that was in the most recent slate of legislative stuff.
I'm just thinking, like, us as non-incarcerated people, mm-hmm. we have to make that change.
Yeah.
Because we haven't been inside, we don't know. So being able to make friends and communicate with incarcerated people so that we can understand what is actually happening in the prisons and be able to make laws and create and vote for laws that will help incarcerated people because they can't do it.
Yeah. What one of the most frustrating parts of the last 2 years for me has been that you saw some of the video that when we would gather for worship, a huge piece of what we do is, and I should have said this at the beginning, our model is all based around the idea of bringing people inside. Bringing in visitors from other congregations, from individuals, to come inside, have that face-to-face, and experience that human connection. And realize that these guys who are sitting there in this worship body are simply human beings, worthy of love and opportunity and, you know, chances. And it's been incredibly frustrating the last couple of years during the pandemic that I can't do that. I've been able to go out and speak about it, but I haven't been able to bring people in. And that is, it's really frustrating because that is like the foundational piece to the model we use, is doing that and breaking down those barriers. And one of my favorite things is how often people will come out of it and just say, I can't believe how normal that was. Like, it was just church. You know, I also get a lot of folks who will say to me afterwards, I really thought it was going to be more Lutheran. And I love it when they say that because it's an opportunity for me to then push a bit and be like, well, what do you mean by that? Yeah. And it always, when they say that, always what it means is, well, there weren't, you know, this certain hymn or this certain prayer or this certain piece of liturgy wasn't done in this certain way. And it's this great opportunity for me as a pastor to unpack that and really help them understand that that isn't inherently Lutheran. Those are accoutrements. That's, you know, it's window dressing in some ways. Like, it's meaningful, don't get me wrong, but it's meaningful because of that history that you have with it, that experience you have with it. Like, I'm a cradle-to-grave Lutheran, realistically. If you popped out, like, one of the settings from the old Lutheran Book of Worship, the Green Book, LBW, and you pop one of those out on a Sunday morning, my heart's going to be happy. It will speak to me in a way that it will not speak to my son because he's not had that experience. That it will not speak to Alex or to Chris because they've not had that experience. And it doesn't make it wrong and it doesn't make them wrong. It just means that it's not inherently the thing. And so one of the great things also about this experience of doing ministry in this context, and where I think it is actually applicable for you when you go out of here to wherever you go back, is that part of doing this ministry has been an opportunity for us to really break down what does it actually mean for us to gather? What does it mean for us to express our faith? Like, for me as a Lutheran-trained pastor, I often use the example of my glasses. Because most of the guys that I work with don't have a Lutheran background or even necessarily like an organized Christian background. And what I often say to them is that, you know, yeah, I'm a ELCA pastor. But in many ways, that Lutheran piece is like these glasses. I'm nearsighted. As soon as I took this off, you all became very blurry. The world does not make as much sense to me now. And as soon as I put them on, now it does. It's come into focus and I can see better. But if I gave them to you, it might not help. It might make things worse. And I think wrestling with that kind of denominational identity and that kind of, like, you know, what are the core pieces has been a really awesome experience. You know, that for us, like, what I've really broken it down to for them is it's about grace, it's about gospel, it's about, like, centering in that piece, that story, that opportunity for forgiveness and for love and starting from there. And for a lot of organizations that go into the prisons right now, frankly, that's not the mindset. The mindset is we are here to save some souls for Jesus. We are going to redeem some sinners. But the thing is, as cynical as I might feel about that mindset, they show up. They freaking show up, and that matters. A couple of the guys I've worked with in Monroe for the last 5 months, I find their theology abhorrent. They're religious bigots. They're homophobes. They're misogynists. I cannot stand talking theology with these two men who I'm thinking of right now. I disagree with them on almost everything to my core. But you know what? Part of me, they fucking show up. And I know that sounds weird, but it matters. Because when we don't show up, someone else is going to fill that void.
Yep.
Someone else is going to be in there, and they're going to preach a message of hate and exclusion. They're going to tell these guys that the only way that they can be fixed is to follow some sort of narrow theology. And that is crap. There was a thing I read a long time ago. I think this is related. We'll see if it goes there or not. But I love it, so I'm going to share it with you anyway. Sorry. Not really. There was this researcher in England years ago who studied luck, which sounds insane. But I'm interested in random stuff, so I found it interesting. And I forget a lot of the details, but the basic core of what he was doing is he was curious how some people seem to identify as lucky and some people seem to not. And so one of the stories, one of the studies that he ran is he did he put out an ad basically asking for volunteers who either self-identified as lucky or who didn't, who have self-identified as unlucky. And then he had them do a series of things, but the one I remember the most was he had them look through this newspaper. And the task they had was very simple. Go through this newspaper, count up how many photographs there are, and then just write down the number. That was the task. Trust me, there is a point to this. The people who self-identified as unlucky took something like 10 times as long as the people who self-identified as lucky. The reason for this was, on one of those pages, in giant text, were the words, stop. There are exactly 37 photos in this. This is not a trick. Write it down. You are done. The people who self-identified as unlucky didn't see it. Because they were looking for something very specific. They had a very specific task. And they just saw it as, I must find the photos. And when the word showed up, they ignored it because it wasn't the thing they were looking for. The people who self-identified as lucky, they saw it because they were open to the opportunity. They were open to the possibility that there were other things that might be relevant. And so they noticed it, and then they acted upon it. And I think there is actually a really important life lesson in there, not just in general, but also around the prisms, where it is so easy for us to go in there with a very narrow mindset and not be open to the possibility of what we might find. That first time that I went into Living Stones, I did not expect to find what I found. And if I had just been focused on what I thought I was going in for, I would have missed it. But instead, I found this community that was so filled with hope and love and welcomed me. And I could have missed that opportunity, but I didn't, because I allowed myself to be open to it. And I think of the same thing every time people come in with us as visitors or as volunteers, that when they allow themselves to be open to the possibility that something might shake their world, that they allow themselves to be open to the possibility that they might find a new way of being, they get to experience something far beyond what they ever could have planned for. It's almost lunchtime. Yeah.
Just for another view inside the tombs, my pen pal in San Quentin Death Rows told me about one of his neighbors there that, I don't know if anyone's read the book called Buddhists on Death Row. And it's really interesting because, well, it gives you, if you want a view of San Quentin Death Row through this person's eyes, but also he's decided to convert, he's converted his life into a Buddhist monastery. So he does this whole, and he's making, he said, you know, Buddhists go to caves and don't see anything, that's what I'm doing. And it's just a very interesting view of San Quentin Death Row.
Thank you.
Back to this question.
Yeah.
In Minnesota, the governor established an ombudsperson office in the DOC, so I believe if someone feels that they've been treated capriciously by a guard, they can make a report to that office.
And Washington also has an ombuds related to the DOC, and I thank you for bringing that up. It's structures within the DOC themselves are typically slow and bureaucratic, and yet they are the structures that are there. And so, like, it's I find myself torn because on the one part there's the part of me that just is very frustrated with how slow that process is. And there's the other part of me that recognizes that staying with it and grinding it, our way through it is how change most often will occur within it. And so, like, yeah, thank you. Chris has a really cool thing that we wanted to close off with today, and I think Thursday is going to be, today's Wednesday, Friday is going to be all sorts of Q&A. Like, we're basically just going to kind of open it up for you to fire off stuff, and we'll address it. But right now we want to close off with this. I'm going to keep talking till you stand up, dude. Like,
awesome. Hopefully what you're hearing, is this on?
Yeah.
Mic's on?
Yeah.
All right, cool. What you're hearing from Chris's approach might sound a little different than some other prison ministries that he alluded to, where it's more about going in and saving souls. And I was really interested to learn over the last few years that the role of the prison chaplain, which Chris has a larger story about that role, almost crushed his soul in the last 5 months of trying to take that
almost.
That the role of the prison chaplain has a history of religion going into slave plantations in America.
Bingo.
Where the role of the chaplain is actually there to bless and Christianize and normalize the whole structure of subjugation and captivity. Mm-hmm. And that it's actually some of the worst theology we get wasn't just from certain movements in Northern Europe, but it actually was forged in slavery America, whereas they needed a disembodied spirituality to say, hey, the whole reason, this is actually a good thing that you're here and you were dragged off of another continent and you were extracted from your homes and have become human chattel property because now your soul can go elsewhere. And that we've normalized this kind of our faith is really a theological monster forged in slavery chaplaincy. And so that theological tradition has been maintained as a way that chaplains can go in as a way to actually bless and normalize the system of captivity they're coming into, as opposed to subverting it. And so that's what we're trying to invite here, and entering the tombs and the theologies of, like, Christ the Conqueror of Hell. If anyone wants to pick up a book while they're here this week, up front, this has been exciting for me, especially in the Syriac tradition of Ephraim of Syria in the 6th century, writing so many hymns, elaborating this big dramatic battle between the invading prison break leader of Christ entering Hades, the realm of the dead, and overcoming warden Satan and letting free all captives. And so this is a different way of entering the tombs, not as an apparatus of the state, but as a quiet, subversive prison break spirituality. And so when I went into Folsom Prison a few years ago, has anyone seen, like, Walk the Line, Johnny Cash? It's a big stony fortress. I went in there to learn contemplative prayer because I'd always not trusted contemplative prayer because I felt it was kind of looked like a wealthy, liberal, white hobby, spirituality. And I liked it, but this guy was doing it inside of a prison. And so when I went into this prison to do contemplative prayer, we went in through the big stony gates out front, and then we got wanded. Turn around, you get wanted. Then you go down another place where they show our badge. We go down another stairwell. We went through a long tier that you see in any prison movies they film there in California. Then we'd go out into the yard, and we had to get checked again and wanded and sign another place and turn in our badges. And we kept going down and down and down and down until we finally got to Greystone Chapel. It was a room a lot larger than this circle of chairs. And the leader of the contemplative prayer was, before we sat in total silence, which we're going to do in just a minute to end right now, he totally flipped my lid on what we're doing here. He said, what we're going to do when we sit in silence is we're going to get underneath the stories we tell ourselves. It's because religion is really the jurisdictions of language, which is still a way of controlling and staying above what we don't want to engage. When we go into silence, all that stuff we don't want comes up, and so what we're going to do is let that stuff come up and get underneath our words and the stories we tell ourselves. And so for the next 20 minutes, as I'm sitting with men and some women in Folsom Prison, is hearing the sounds out on the yard and realizing what we're trying to do in contemplative prayer is descend. This all of today is about the movement of God descending into the tombs. And what we're trying to do in prayer and in a good psychology is to descend into the place down beneath, almost like the prison within. And I realized what we were doing entering this prison, we're really entering prisons as entering the subconscious of a nation, so to say. What we do in here is what we do out there. prisons started, I started to see as the places of mass repression, and we can start to practice welcoming and going to the place that we don't want to go inside. Sure enough, on our way out, coming out of Folsom Prison, it has its own postal code. I didn't know that. It wasn't Folsom, California. It was called Represa, California. And so what we want to do, and we're going to talk about this more tomorrow with how we go and practice inviting churches to do one parish, one prisoner with us, is the dissent is first. And we're going to talk about writing prison letters and developing friendships. But our core rhythm we have is doing the welcoming prayer, which Alex is going to lead us into, which is a series of statements of welcoming. Well, I didn't put it back. Alex, you got one right here? Is we're wanting to practice inside this welcome, because if we are a people in a culture that represses what is too difficult, represses the sexuality, the anger, the violence, as a culture we do that internally, of course we're going to be the country that has the greatest system of mass repression and 2.4 million people locked up. And so, yes, we need to legislate differently, but the reason we as a country, I think, are voting for mass repression is because we are people into mass repression. And so some of the change is right here. And so, Alex, if you would welcome us, we'll do this a little bit to start again tomorrow, reading us the welcoming prayer, if you can welcome us into settling down, and we're going to practice prison ministry and dissent within as well. And there's parts of ourselves that we don't like. And if we can learn to embrace them and welcome them and their scattered, angry, uncooperative parts of ourselves, we'll be better equipped to befriend them in our communities and in lockdown facilities.
Okay. Well, if you can close your eyes, I'm going to start real quick about how I learned about welcoming prayer. It was 2016. I was in Stafford Creek doing a program in the hole, and I had been saving my one phone call for about 7 months, and I called Chris. And I said, hey, I'm not getting how to pray. God's not talking back to me, homie. You know, he's not, I feel like he's not listening. I feel like my head is just filled with all these negative thoughts. And he said, hey, well, try this. Close your eyes and just focus on one word. What word comes to you? And I went back to my cell, and I was looking at my, I was reading a Stephen King It, which is a good book. And I was looking at it, and I was trying to think of a word, and I closed my eyes, and immediately, like a whiteboard in the clouds, the word forgiveness came up. And so I focused on that word. So I closed my eyes, and I just, whatever came to me, I accepted it. If I got distracted, I pulled back that word in my head. And so it worked for me. It worked for me. And now when I do centering prayer, it reminds me of Southern Utah. So this is a welcoming prayer. I welcome everything that comes to me in this moment because I trust it can be part of my healing. I welcome all thoughts, feelings, emotions, persons, situations, and conditions. I let go of my desire for approval. I let go of my desire for control. I let go of my desire for false security. I let go of my desire to change any situation, condition, or person for myself. I open to the love and presence of God and the healing action and grace within. So you just relax, roll your shoulders back, take a couple deep breaths, and find your word. It could be a positive word, it could be a negative word. Just find that word. And if you feel yourself getting distracted, come back to that word. We'll take 2 minutes. Embrace that word. trust it, understand it. How do you guys feel? Whose word was lunch? Thank you. Yeah, day three tomorrow. I usually do 5 minutes, but sometimes I want to sit there longer with that word or with whatever it is. And what stands out for me is I let go of my desire for control. I do this. So there's copies right there. The welcoming prayer for whoever wants one. Thank you.